I could have been fourth guy from the left in the 14 fists of McCluskey, but you, pointing his Brandy Alexander at Rick, could have been the fucking Cooler King. Not this fucking McQueen horseshit again, Rick thinks. Cliff winces, knowing how much Rick hates this story. Rick tries to wave the story away, telling Stacy, come on, man. We already went through that shit. Warren Banders asks Stacy what he's talking about. Jim takes his Brandy Alexander and points it at Rick again and performs for the group of men. This fucking prick came this close, holding up two fingers on the other hand an inch apart, to getting the McQueen role in The Great Escape. Both Kurt and Warren Banders give big reactions to that revelation. Rick holds up his own two fingers an inch apart and says, I didn't come this close. Then Rick spreads both arms as wide as they go and says, I came this close. The other men laugh but contradict what they mistake as humble pie. That close is fucking huge in my book, says Warren Banders. Kurt Zastapel shrugs. Oh, he almost got McQueen's signature role. No big deal. Stacy points at Kurt. Exactly. Then he turns to Rick and waves his finger at the group of men. Tell him about it. Fuck me, Rick thinks. I'm not going to tell this same fucking story twice in one goddamn day. Especially to the same fucking guy. Seriously, Rick says to the group, there ain't nothing to tell. It's just Sportsman's Lodge gossip. So since Rick is being demure, Jim Stacy jumps in and tells it himself. Apparently, McQueen almost didn't do it, so the director draws up a list. Four names, top of the list, pointing at Rick. This fucking guy! He's making up that top of the list part, Rick clarifies. Warren Banders asks, who are the other three? Jim answers for Rick, the other three, get a load of this, the three Georges. Which three Georges? Kurt asks. Pappard, Maharis, and Chakiris, Jim tells him. Both Kurt and Warren wince, with Kurt adding, shit, between them three faggots, you would have totally gotten it. What did I tell you? Jim says to Rick, then to Kurt, that's what I said. Then Maynard yells from behind the bar, Kurt, I hope you enjoyed your little break. Now entertain the other 30 people in the room. Jim, Rick, and Cliff and Warren leave the piano area, and Kurt sits back down on his bench and gets to work. These eyes cry every night for you. These arms long to hold you again. The other men belly back up to the bar where Maynard serves them another round. That's round three for Rick and Jim, and tap beer number two for Cliff. Cliff pays for the round. Warren Banders pays his tab, says goodbye to the boys, and leaves while he still can drive. On nights like these, Cliff doesn't usually say much. It's not like he's biting his tongue. He interjects from time to time, but he knows these nights aren't about him. It's about two male actor colleagues sniffing around each other to build both an artistic and working relationship. This is their night. The two remaining television actors continue to talk and drink and do what actors of their time usually do, compare notes. Usually about directors and actors they both worked with. It turns out Stacy knows Tommy Laughlin too, from acting in Tommy's first film as a director, The Young Sinner. Stacy worked with the director of Tanner, Jerry Hopper, on A Have Gun Will Travel, and both men worked with Vic Morrow. Vic did A Bounty Law, and Jim did an episode of Morrow's show, Combat. They also talk about directors they like, which usually means directors who like them and hired them. Rick sings the praises of Paul Wencoss and William Whitney, while Stacy champions Robert Butler. So how did you get so set up with CBS, Dalton asks Stacy. Well, you know how it is, Stacy says. You work for this TV director, you work for that one. Then you work for one who really digs you. Then you become one of his guys. If he does four episodes a year on different shows, he might plug you in one or two, if he can. Yeah, I had that situation with Paul Wencoase and Bill Whitney, Rick adds. So my guy, who I thought I was his guy, Stacy says, was Robert Butler. He plugged me into a few of his shows. And even the shows I didn't get because they wanted a bigger name, an Andy Prine or a John Saxon. I impressed the casting directors and the producers, Stacy continues. So word about me started to spread at CBS. Then this big deal, two-part Gunsmoke, came up. And they didn't just give it to me. I had to win it. I had to impress the network executives, the Gunsmoke producers, and the episode director, Dick Sarafian. Dick Sarafian wrote the script of my first lead role in a motion picture, Rick interjected.
Really? Stacy said. What was it?
A hot rod picture for Republic called Drag Race No Stop. Bill Whitney directed it. It had good cast. Gene Evans, John Ashley, Dick Bacallion. I beat out Bob Conrad for the lead. Rick jokes. Whitney didn't want to dig a hole every day for the other actors to stand in so Bob could look them in the eye. They all laugh at the Robert Conrad short joke. Then Rick asked Stacy about the Gunsmoke episode. So the network executives were buttoned into the casting of an episodic? Well, that's the thing, Stacy explains. They could have just gone the big name route. And Chris George gets the role. But they didn't want a big name. CBS wanted to cast a young actor and use that episode of Gunsmoke to establish him with a Western watching audience and then plug him into his own show next season. Well, saluting Jim with his empty whiskey sour glass, Rick says, "You're a lucky goddamn son of a bitch, and I hope you appreciate that." Jim Stacy bristles a bit. I wouldn't say I'm lucky. I'm fortunate. I mean, it's not like I hit town and just fell off a turnip truck. I spent 7 years on fucking Ozzy and Harriet saying, "Hey, Ricky, want a hamburger?" Rick clarifies, "Whoa, whoa, whoa. I didn't say you didn't deserve it. And I didn't imply that either. I watched you today, and you totally fucking deserve it. I'm just saying, I've been you. It was me guesting on a Tales of Wells Fargo that got the town excited about me. And that directly led to Bounty Law. Anyway, my point is, this is a moment for you. And I hope you appreciate the moment better than I did." "You didn't appreciate it then?" Jim asks. "I did," Rick assures him, but then jabs him in the shoulder with his empty cocktail glass and says, "But not like I do now." After Maynard sets them up with Rick's fourth whiskey sour and Jim's fourth Brandy Alexander and Cliff's third beer, they start talking about sexy male actor's favorite subject, pussy. Jim wants to know, did Rick fuck Verna Lisi? And Rick wants to know, did Jim fuck Haley Mills? Jim didn't. Or if he did, he's not talking. Rick didn't, but he tried. Rick tells Jim how he fucked Yvonne DiCarlo and Faith Domingue when they guessed it on Bounty Law. He fucked DiCarlo basically because since he was 12, he always wanted to fuck Elizabeth Taylor. And he figured Yvonne DiCarlo was about as close as he was gonna ever get. "Was it hard starting up an affair with Yvonne DiCarlo?" Jim asks. Rick lifts up his empty cocktail glass and says, "About as hard as ordering another whiskey sour." They all three laugh at Rick's line and his timing. Jim orders another round, but Cliff passes on a fourth beer. The two actors wait for Maynard to bring them their last round of cocktails. Rick knows he has to still get home and work on his lines for tomorrow's shoot. God forbid he doesn't know his lines backward and forward when he has to play a scene with that little bitch. She'll probably know her lines and his lines. That just means this is his last drink. When he goes to bed tonight, he's going to remember in the morning going to bed. But before he and his co-star say adios, Rick says, "Jim, yeah? You know that great escape shit you asked me about? Yeah? I don't enjoy that story as much as everybody else seems to," Rick confesses. "I mean, if I were Cesare De Nova, fair enough, but my situation ain't his situation." "Wait a minute," says a confused Stacy. What the hell does Cesare de Nova got to do with it, and what's his situation? Well, Rick explains, once upon a time, for 2 minutes, William Wyler seriously considered casting Cesare de Nova as Ben-Hur.
Really? Shit, I didn't know that.
You didn't know it because 2 minutes later, Wyler came to his senses and cast Charlton Heston. Rick explains further. But you can say Cesare de Nova was almost Ben-Hur, because he almost was. But his situation wasn't my situation. Jim stares at Rick, wondering what he's getting at. The actor continues, I worked real hard on Bounty Law. And if that's what I'm known for, fair enough. But the thing that seems to interest everybody the most isn't the show I did. It's a fucking role I never played. A role I never had a Chinaman's chance of getting. You were on the list, Jim offers. The list. The fucking list, Rick says, raising his voice in frustration. Maynard and a few other customers turn in their direction. Jim reaches over and pats Rick's hand on the bar and says quietly, it's okay. Calm down, take a drink. Rick sucks some more whiskey sour out of his straw as Jim looks at him with big eyes. That list, Rick repeats in a sarcastic whisper, that everybody thinks is so impressive, is fucking questionable. I mean, I never saw it. But let's just say there is a list and I'm on it, and the three Georges are on it. Rick asks, do you realize how many crazy, impossible things would have to happen for me to get that role? Jim states, I don't follow. First things first, Rick begins. McQueen has got to do the dumbest thing in his life, turn down the Great Escape and accept the victors. You know, that thing he didn't do because he's not a fucking idiot. Then Rick stops and says, but for the sake of argument, we'll say McQueen is a fucking idiot. And he turns down the flashy role in the epic movie written for him by his mentor, John Sturges. Does that mean I get Hiltz, the Cooler King? Rick asks Jim. Before Jim can answer, Rick says, of course not. If there was a list, at the time, George Peppard would have been right at the top of it, Rick insists. I mean, there's not even a question about that. And if McQueen turned them down, they would have just turned around and offered it to Peppard. And since the role that Peppard did was the role in The Victors that McQueen turned down, if offered The Great Escape, Peppard would have not been an idiot and said yes immediately. And that, Mr. Stacy, would have been that, Rick concludes. Makes sense, Jim thinks as he smiles at Rick's delivery. But little does James Stacy know Rick ain't finished yet. But Rick starts up again. For sake of argument, let's say before he can play the role, Peppard drives his Aston Martin off of Mulholland. No, wait a minute, that's too cliche. Peppard gets eaten by a shark surfing in Malibu. So thus, he's unavailable. Rick sums up the situation for Stacy again, making sure he's keeping up with the train of thought. So McQueen does the dumbest thing he's ever done in his whole life, and Peppard gets eaten by a shark. Now do I get it? The actor asks the other actor. Jim nods his head up and down. But Rick moves his head side to side, then explaining to James Stacy as if he were a 5-year-old child, no, I don't get it. George Maharis gets it. Jim Stacy starts to argue, but Rick holds his hand up to stop him before he starts. Now, why do I say that? I'll tell you. Rick proceeds to explain. Look, because of that TV show of his in 62, he was pretty popular. Not only that, 2 years later, Sturges cast Maharis in the lead in a thriller called The Satan Bug, which suggests he's partial to Maharis. I mean, he didn't cast me in the fucking Satan Bug. So Rick continues. If Steve McQueen does the dumbest thing he's ever done in his entire life, and George Pappard gets eaten by a shark, then George Maharis is Hiltz, the Cooler King. Rick lifts up his cocktail, sips some sour booze through his straw, toasting Maharis. But for sake of argument, let's say before principal photography, Maharis gets caught having sex with a man in a public toilet. Jim Stacy bursts out laughing. Rick continues. So now Maharis is out. And Sturgis goes back to the list. So do I get it now? Over George Takaris? Fuck yeah, insists Stacy. Rick shakes his head from side to side and tells Jim, no, 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 Jim. Of course, they offer it to George Takaris. Stacy makes a face that indicates he disagrees, and Rick proceeds to demonstrate his point by raising his hand and counting off the reasons on his fingers. Finger number one. One. There's that inexplicable Oscar he's got. Stacy nods his head, acknowledging, yes, that's a thing. Finger number two. Two. The Great Escape was produced by the Mirisch brothers for the Mirisch Company. Finger number three. George Takiris has a deal with the Mirisch Company. He made the 633 Squadron with him. He made Diamond Head with him. He made that goofy Aztec movie with him. So not only do they like him, he's under fucking contract with him. Seeing the logic in Rick's hypothesis, Jim Stacy nods his head, yes. Dalton sums up. So, George Takaris gets it, and that's that. Stacy nods his head in agreement and starts to say something when Rick stops him with an upward-pointing index finger. But, let's just say, for sake of argument, McQueen does the dumbest thing he's ever done in his life. Pappard gets eaten by a shark in Malibu. Maharis gets caught fucking a man in a public toilet. And it turns out the man Maharis was fucking was Jakiris. That makes Stacy do a spit take with his cocktail. So bye-bye, Bernardo, Rick says with a big hand gesture. Then, hunching his shoulders, he asks Jim Stacy, do I get it now? Jim puts down his cocktail. Of course you get it. You're the last guy on the fucking list. That's just my point, Jim, Rick explains. When the fuck do they hire the last guy on the fucking list? When you get to the last guy on the fucking list, you throw out the fucking list and start a new fucking list. Shit, Stacy thinks. That is what they do. So now it's not the three fucking Georges. It's the two fucking Bobs, Redford and Culp. And now they decide to make the guy British. And all of a sudden, Michael Caine's got the fucking part. Or, Rick concludes, they decide to say, fuck it, and pay Paul Newman what he's asking for. Or Tony Curtis's people call up and offer them a good deal on Tony. Regardless, I never stood a fucking chance. Then Rick catches Cliff's eye and indicates it's time to bounce by placing his empty glass on the bar with a theatrical demonstration of finality. And with that, Mr. Lancer, I bid you adieu. I got a shit-fuck ton of lines to learn tonight, and I better learn them or get my eggs scrambled tomorrow by that snotty little dynamo. Chapter 24, Nebraska Jim. After bidding Jim Stacy and the regulars at the Drinkers Hall of Fame adieu, Cliff drops Rick off at his house around 10:30 that night. Enough time for Rick to study his lines for tomorrow's work and hit the hay around midnight or 12:30. As soon as Rick walks through the door, as per usual for every actor in the world, he checks in with his answering service to see if he's received any important messages, and sure enough, there is one from the agent, Marvin Schwarz.
Wow, that's fast, Rick thinks.
So he quickly dials the number the agent left, and Marvin picks up the phone on the third ring. Marvin Schwarz answers the phone.
Marvin Schwarz.
Hello, Mr. Schwarz, Rick says into the receiver. It's Rick Dalton.
Rick, my boy, the agent gregariously answers. So glad you called. I've got two words for you. Nebraska Jim. Sergio Corbucci.
Nebraska what? Sergio who? Rick asks.
Sergio Corbucci, Marvin repeats.
And who's that?
The second best director of spaghetti westerns in the whole wide world, Marvin informs him. He's doing a new western. It's called Nebraska Jim. And because of me, he's considering you.
Nebraska Jim? Am I Nebraska Jim?
Yes, you are.
So he's offering it to me?
No, he's not.
So I don't have it.
What you have is a dinner.
He just met three young actors. Thanks to me, he's now meeting four.
You.
Thursday after next, Sergio and his wife, Nori, at his favorite Japanese restaurant in Los Angeles.
Who's the other three? Rick inquires.
Marvin rattles them off. Robert Fuller, Gary Lockwood, Ricky Nelson, and Ty Harden.
That's four, Rick points out.
Oh, that's right, Marvin realizes.
Sorry about that. You're five.
Ricky Nelson? Rick incredulously asks. He's considering fucking Ricky Nelson.
Oh, honey boy, Marvin reminds him. Ricky Nelson was one of the stars of Rio Bravo. That's a hell of a better movie than anyone you've ever made.
Look, Mr. Schwarz, Rick stutters.
That's terrific. But can I talk straight with you?
Always, Marvin says.
When it comes to this spaghetti western stuff, Rick starts.
Yeah.
I don't like them.
You don't like them?
No, I don't. In fact, I think they're awful.
Awful?
Yeah.
How many have you seen?
A couple.
So this is your expert opinion.
Look, Mr. Schwarz, I grew up watching Hopalong Cassidy and Hoot Gibson. This Italian cowboy shit just ain't my bag.
Because they're awful, the agent clarifies.
Yeah. As opposed to the high-quality red-letter work of Hopalong Cassidy and Hoot Gibson.
Come on, you know what I mean.
Look, Rick, the agent says. I don't want to be insensitive here, but your track record when it comes to motion pictures isn't so stellar that you should be looking down your nose at feature films considering hiring you for leading roles.
I appreciate that, Mr. Schwarz, Rick concedes. But maybe, instead of running off to Rome, it's wiser for me to stay in town and give it my best shot next pilot season. I mean, somebody's gonna get lucky. It just might be me.
Look, kid, Marvin says, let me tell you a story about a client of mine. Before we sent cowboys to ride horses around the sets of Cinecittà, we used to send them to Berlin. Before the fucking Italians got the bright idea to make westerns, the Germans got in the game, Marvin explains. You see, there was this German novelist named Karl May, and he wrote a series of books that take place in the American Northwest during the pioneer days. Now, the fact Karl May never set foot in America didn't stop these books from becoming very popular with the German public. The books follow the exploits of two men, one an Apache chief named Winnetou, and the other his white mountain man blood brother, Old Shatterhand. So in the 50s, a German film company started making German movies based on these novels. They cast a French actor named Pierre Bryce to play the Indian. But as Old Shatterhand, I got them to cast my He-Man American client, Lex Barker. Now, before Lex went to Germany, he did a few American movies. He even played Tarzan, and was a pretty fucking good Tarzan, if you ask me. But he was married to Lana Turner. So no matter what he fucking did, he was always Mr. Lana Turner. So I get him the German picture, and he don't want to go. A German Western, what the fuck is that? A German Western with a French fucking Indian? He says, Marvin, what the fuck are you trying to do to me? There's gotta be a limit to what an actor will do for money. And I tell him, like I'm telling you, what's your fucking problem? One, there's not exactly a long line of people in America who want to hire you to star in their motion pictures. Two, you're not joining the fucking army. You go to Germany, make a movie 5 weeks, 6 weeks, make some good money, come back, easy peasy, in and out. So I get him to go. And the rest, as they say, is German cinema history. The movie is a fucking smashola. And not just in Germany, but all over Europe. Lex ends up playing Old Shatterhand 6 times. He becomes one of the most popular actors in the history of German cinema. But his movies play all over Europe. So he's popular in Italy. Fellini casts him in La Dolce Vita. And you know who he plays? Lex Barker. That's how big a star he is. After 6 movies, he retires from the role. They replace him with big American stars like Stuart Granger and Rod Cameron. But they don't call them Old Shatterhand. They call them shit like Old Scatterhand and Old Surehand and Old Firehand. Why? Because everybody in Germany knows Lex Barker. And only Lex Barker is Old Shatterhand. The agent gets down to brass tacks. Look, honey boy, you asked me, could you speak straight with me? Well, now I'm gonna speak straight with you. You tried the TV to movies transition, and it didn't work. Well, it rarely does, so welcome to the fucking club. Using examples that don't include Rick, Marvin says, yes, it worked for McQueen, and it worked for Jim Garner, and most unbelievably of all, Clint Eastwood. But guys like you, Ed Burns, Vince Edwards, George Maharis, who spent your careers running pocket combs through your pompadours, you're all in the same boat now. When you weren't looking, the culture changed. You gotta be somebody's hippie son to star in movies nowadays. Peter Fonda, Michael Douglas, Don Siegel's kid, Christopher Tabori, Arlo fucking Guthrie, shaggy-haired androgynous types. Those are the leading men of today. Marvin pauses for effect, then says, you still wear a fucking pompadour. Fucking Elvis don't wear a pompadour no more. Ricky fucking Nelson don't wear a goddamn pompadour no more. Ed fucking Cookie Burns is on TV doing commercials for fucking hairspray, saying the wet head is dead, long live the dry look. Fucking kooky. But not you, Rick. You're sticking with the fucking pompadour. Rick excitedly tells him, well, you know this thing I shot yesterday? I didn't wear a pompadour. Well, it's about fucking time, Marvin says. If you ask me, you should have started using hairspray and a hot comb years ago. Then Marvin switches gears, but that's not the point. The point is, in Italy, you do what you want. You want to suddenly get all flamboyant, like Tony Curtis, have a ball. You want to wear your hair like you did for the last 20 years, fucking fine. Italians don't give a shit. You know all this hippie shit all over town, all over America? Same shit happened in Rome. Different. The Italians threw the bums out. Consequently, the youth culture didn't dominate popular culture like these hippie faggots do over here. Hippie faggots, Rick repeats under his breath with bitterness. Then the great Marvin Schwarz goes in for the clothes. So, Rick, here's the $64,000 question. Where do you want to be this time next year? In Burbank, getting your ass kicked in by that Schwarzer on Mod Squad. Or in Rome, starring in Westerns. Chapter 25. The Last Chapter. Roman and Sharon Polanski are in their convertible English roadster, speeding down the Sunset Strip. Sharon hates this car. She hates how old it is. She hates the noise it makes when Roman shifts gears. She hates the shitty radio reception it gets. But most of all, she hates that it's a convertible, and that Roman always insists on driving it with the top down. Roman jokes with Warren Beatty that life's too short not to drive a convertible. That's easy for him to say, with that pageboy hairstyle he wears. But Sharon works hard on getting her hair right. And after getting her hair done and looking fabulous, she must tie it up in a scarf. It's a crime against beauty. The Hollywood couple have completed their appearance on Hugh Hefner's TV show Playboy After Dark. It's 10 o'clock as they race away from the Sunset 9000 building, where the show is taped, and whiz by Ben Frank's coffee shop and the Tiffany Theater, which features Andy Warhol's Lonesome Cowboys on its marquee. Roman knows he shouldn't have agreed to another event the day after the party at the Playboy Mansion, and he senses her hostile silence. He is well aware she was planning to spend the night at home reading in bed, and he knows it's much more work for her to get dolled up for these TV appearances than it is for him. Nevertheless, she did get dolled up. She did leave the house, and she did come through for him. But now comes the Cold War resentment. Sharon has such a sunny presence that whenever she blocks out the sun, the effect is chilling. On 93 KHJ, nighttime disc spinner Humble Harv keeps coming in and out of the roadster's shitty speakers, as does a ridiculous tune by Diana Ross and the Supremes. No matter what sign you are, you're gonna be mine, you are. The time has come for Roman to show contrition and gratitude and poke the blonde bear. Look, darling, he begins. I know you didn't want to do this tonight. The red roof of the Der Wiener Schnitzel on Larrabee is visible through the windshield of the roadster as Sharon glances over at him and nods yes. He continues. And I know you're sore because I didn't consult you, and that was inconsiderate. Again, she shows her agreement by nodding her head. And I know, he continues. You're being very good-natured about this. Actually, she bitched about it all afternoon with Jay, but Roman doesn't know that. Finally, the blonde sphinx speaks. Yes, all those things are true. You're being an angel about it, he tells her, and I love you for that. Oh, so that's why you love me, she thinks, and does an eye roll. The eye roll tells him that probably wasn't the best thing he could have said. As they drive past the London fog on one side of the strip and the whiskey a go-go on the other, Roman tries to parlay with her. So, just know, I owe you. Quickly, she comes back with a question. Owe me what? I mean, I owe you for doing this. I know, I agree. So what do you intend to do to pay me back? Frankly, Roman hadn't taken that statement as serious as Sharon apparently did.
so he's at a bit of a loss.
Well, I guess I mean, he's thinking fast, that you can suddenly commit me to something I don't want to do.
Yeah, that's it, he thinks. That would be pound for pound, reciprocation. Giving her examples of what that could be, he says, I mean, you come across some charity, you're really serious. She interrupts him with two words. Pool party.
What?
Pool party.
Pool party, sure. When?
Tonight.
Tonight?
Yes, tonight.
Oh, baby, I'm so tired. I'm leaving for London tomorrow. I was looking forward to going home and...
Wah, wah, wah. That's what I said last night when you committed us to this fucking thing. But where am I? I'm right here, all glammed up, doing my sexy little me routine for Hugh Hefner, the television cameras, and a bunch of Hollywood dingbats.
Then she says, like an accusation,
you know I'm reading a book right now.
He nods his head yes.
You know I want to be in my bed reading right now.
He nods his head yes.
You know I don't like to put on the dog two nights in a row if I don't have to.
He nods his head yes.
But I did it, didn't I?
Roman lets out a groan.
Don't moan at me, Buster, she admonishes him.
Roman tries to deflect.
You just had your hair done. Nice try, buddy, Sharon thinks. Is there some reason I'm unhip to that I need to have my Playboy after dark hair tomorrow?
No, he shrugs, beaten.
No commitments I don't know about? No personal appearances?
No.
I can read my book.
He answers with a sigh.
Yes. Well then, pool party tonight means debt paid in full,
then adds for effect.
If that means anything to you.
Okay, says Roman, letting out a defeated exhale.
Okay. Now say it with a smile on your face.
He smiles and says, we can have a pool party. Then she demands,
now ask me for it.
That makes him roll his eyes. Really? You're taking it this far?
Ask me for it, she insists.
Roman swallows his irritation, puts on an accommodating face, and gives Sharon what she wants.
Sharon, how would you like to throw a pool party tonight?
Sharon squeals, claps her hands together, and says,
Roman, that's a fantastic idea.
She leans across to kiss him and says, let's get home. I have phone calls to make. Rick notices a steady line of cars arriving at the Polanski residence. They must be having a party, he thinks. Rick Dalton stands in his driveway. Dressed in the red silk kimono he bought on one of his trips to Japan, watering the roses in his garden with a hose while he runs tomorrow's dialogue with his tape recorder. A Japanese gardener once told him to water his roses at night, so they fully get to drink the nourishment and not have the sun evaporate a large portion of it. He's running the lines of the scene he has with the little girl tomorrow. No way is he going to let that little monster catch him flat-footed. Cliff had dropped him off from that bar in San Gabriel around 10:30. He talked to Marvin Schwarz on the phone for about 20 minutes. He made a German beer stein's worth of whiskey sours and started running his lines. He's run them for about an hour now. It's 5 minutes to midnight, and he's feeling pretty good about his grasp of the dialogue. Before he's tempted to make another beer stein full of whiskey sours, Rick's going to go to bed. He can hear the sounds of the Polanski party echo down to his driveway. He can hear the music, the giggling, the frivolity, and the periodic splashes in the pool. The actor still has yet to meet either the director or his wife. He only spied the two of them for the first time yesterday afternoon. He looks like a little prick. But she looks sweet. Maybe one day he'll catch her going to fetch the mail.
A convertible Porsche, going much too fast, zooms up Cielo Drive and stops outside of the gate of the Polanski residence. Rick gives the car an irritated glance, then suddenly stops when he recognizes the driver. Fuck me swinging, that's Steve McQueen. Rick calls out, Steve! The driver behind the wheel of the Porsche glances over in the direction of his name being called and sees a guy dressed in a red silk Japanese kimono holding a beer stein, a tape recorder, and a water hose. He narrows his eyes. Then he recognizes the red kimono man. He tentatively answers back, Rick? Dalton walks over to the car. Hey, fella. Long time no see. McQueen answers back. Yeah, you bet. How you been? Dalton leans over and shakes hands with McQueen. Oh, I can't complain. Actually, Rick has nothing but complaints about his career, his life, and the world. But he's not going to complain to Steve. The movie star looks past him to the house. Is that your house? Yep, Rick smiles. That's the house the bounty law built. McQueen raises his eyebrows.
You built it?
No, Dalton says. That's just an expression. You dumb fuck. Steve gives him one of his trademark little smiles with his tiny gash of a mouth. Well, good for you. You are smart with your money. I hear Will Hutchins and Ty Harden are flat on their ass right now. In other words, Rick thinks, you're doing better than the other has-beens. You got a house, so says Bullet. Well, I'm not starring in Sand Pebbles, bringing up McQueen's only Oscar nomination, but I'm making a living. Well, that puts you ahead of 80% of them, McQueen says with a smile and a finger point. The highest paid movie star in the world is congratulating me on making a living as an actor. Thanks a lot. By the way, Dalton says, I was rooting for you for that Oscar nomination, referring again to the Sand Pebbles. McQueen doesn't say anything to that. He just smiles. Rick knows what that means. This little conversation is over. But before the gate opens, and McQueen and his Porsche zoom out of his life, Rick would like to connect with him. Not on the two separate realities they now exist in, but back when the two men shared the same real estate, there was one incident that they shared that Rick could bring up without sounding too pathetic. Hey, Steve, I was wondering, Rick said, do you remember that time? It was during the first season of my show and the second season of your show. That we played pool at Barney's Beanery. Actually, McQueen does remember that. Yeah, he says. I remember that. Going back in time. We played 3 games, right? Yeah, Rick says. Happy Steve remembers it. It was kind of a big deal at the time. You know, Josh and Jake playing pool. McQueen gives it to him. Well, it was a big deal. Josh and Jake. Playing pool? We could have sold tickets. Rick laughs at Steve's joke. Thinking about it, McQueen says, in fact, I seem to remember the whole bar watched us play the first game. McQueen points at him. You won. And only half the bar watched the second game. Then he jerks his thumb toward himself, which I won. And then he laughs when he remembers, and nobody cared about the third game. A very moved Rick nods his head. Yes, he remembers. But I don't remember. Who won the third game? McQueen asks. Nobody, Rick answers. We never finished it. You had to leave. McQueen knows that probably means he was losing. Then another car en route to Sharon's party pulls up behind McQueen's Porsche, bringing the reunion to an end. Both men look back at the other car, then back to each other. So you live there, McQueen says, pointing at Rick's house. Yep, Rick says. Well, maybe one day I'll knock on your door and We can go down to Barney's and finish that game. Rick knows that will never happen, but it's a nice thing to say.
That would be great.
Really meaning it, Rick says.
Good to see you again, Steve.
You too. Take care of yourself.
Then Steve turns toward the call box out in front of the Polanski house and hits the button. Sharon's voice comes out of the speaker.
Hello?
Steve says into the box, It's me, baby. Open up.
The Polanski's front gate opens. Steve's car, and the car behind him, drive up the driveway and disappear from view.
Rick stands there holding his beer stein, the tape recorder, and the garden hose, watching the gate in front of the Polanski residence close itself. He takes a swig of whiskey sour. Then he hears the phone inside the house ring.
Who the fuck's calling at midnight?
He trots inside the house and answers the phone attached to the wall in the kitchen.
Hello, he says.
The female voice on the other end of the line says, Rick?
Yes, he answers.
Are you learning your lines? The voice asks.
What the fuck?
He asks, who is this?
It's Trudy, you know, Mirabella from work.
A genuinely surprised Rick says, Trudy.
Trudy, do you know what time it is?
She groans on the other end of the line.
That's a silly question. Of course I know what time it is. I don't go to bed till I know my line's cold.
I don't believe in this learning your lines during the day malarkey.
Especially not on television.
You don't sound like I woke you up, she asks.
Did I?
No, you didn't, he confesses.
So, she challenges, what's the problem?
You know the problem, he says with irritation creeping into his voice. Does your mother know you're calling?
Trudy guffaws on the other end of the line and tells Rick, By 10:45, my mother has put away 3 to 4 glasses of Chardonnay and is usually sleeping open-mouthed on the couch with the TV on, waiting for the national anthem sign-off to happen to wake her up and send her to the bedroom.
Trudy, you can't call me at this hour, Rick insists.
Are you suggesting it's not appropriate?
It's not appropriate.
Stop trying to change the subject and answer the question.
What question?
Are you learning your lines?
Oh, well, as a matter of fact, little Miss Smartass, I am.
Yeah, right. She says sarcastically.
I am, he insists.
You're watching Johnny Carson, she says dismissively.
I am not. I'm learning my fucking lines, you little bitch.
After losing his cool and calling her a bitch, he hears her little voice giggle on the other end of the receiver. The sound of her giggling makes him giggle. Then, in mid-giggle, she asks,
Are you learning our scene?
Yes, I am, he tells her.
Me too, she says, and then asks, Want to run lines together?
Okay, he thinks, this has gone way too far. He's got to shut this little troublemaker down. Look, Trudy, I really don't think it's okay to be talking on the phone at midnight with your mom not knowing, he says honestly.
With infinite patience, Trudy answers Rick.
You act like tomorrow morning I'm waking up and going to Little Red Schoolhouse. I'm going to work with you. And we're doing this scene. You're up, I'm up. You're working on the scene, I'm working on the scene. So, she suggests, let's work on it together. Then tomorrow, we show up to work, nobody knows we worked on it, and we knock 'em dead.
Then, almost like a dig, she adds, You know, Rick, they don't just pay us to do it. They pay us to do it great.
The little squirt's making sense.
I mean, she is just an acting colleague. And after the way Sam reacted to that last scene we did together, if me and her come out of the gate tomorrow loaded for bear, we would knock 'em dead.
You off book?
He asked the little girl. I think I am, was her reply.
Yeah, me too. Okay, kiddo. You start.
On the other end of the receiver, Trudy suddenly changes her voice to duplicate traumatized kidnap victim Mirabella's overdramatic intensity. What do you intend to do with me? As he paces around his kitchen, dressed in his red silk kimono, Rick takes a swig of a whiskey sour from his beer stein and adopts his Caleb Descartes cowboy dialect.
You know, little lady, I ain't rightly figured that out yet. I could do a lot of things with you. I could do a lot of things to you. But I could also let you go. Your pa sees the right side of things.
Trudy, as Mirabella asks, what's he gotta do for you to let me go? Rick, as Caleb, spits out maniacally,
he can make me a rich man, that's what he can do. He can give me a basket full of money, and then he can forget me. Or I'll give him a basket full of dead daughter, and he'll never forget me.
The innocent child asks the corrupt criminal, so you'd murder me? Not because you're angry with me, or even angry with my father? Trudy takes a dramatic pause, then says, but simply for greed. Caleb answers flippantly,
greed's what makes the world go round, little lady.
The little lady says her name out loud, Mirabella.
What?
Caleb asks. The 8-year-old child repeats her name to the outlaw leader. My name is Mirabella. If you're gonna murder me in cold blood, I don't want you to just think of me as Murdoch Lancer's little girl. Something about the way she says that registers with the outlaw. And suddenly it becomes important for Caleb to make her understand his fairness on this matter.
Look, you ain't got nothing to worry about. Obviously your pa's gonna pay me my money. You're worth it, and he can afford it. So when he does pay me my money, I'll release you unharmed.
There's silence on the other side of the phone for a beat and a half. Then her voice comes back on the line. Only now, instead of being overly dramatic, she makes a surprisingly analytical observation. Interesting choice of words.
What?
A confused Caleb asks. Then Mirabella Lancer, sounding remarkably like Trudy Frazier, explains her observation to the land pirate leader. You said my money. It's my father's money. The money he earned, not stole. Raising cattle and driving them to market. But you said my money. You actually think you're entitled to my father's money? And with that delivery, little Mirabella and little Trudy push little buttons inside of the psyche of both the outlaw and the actor. And in the middle of his kitchen, dressed in his red silk kimono, Rick Dalton, as Caleb Descartes, metamorphoses back into the snarling, megalomaniacal, murdering bandit he always was, and answers her in one big explosion of breath.
That's right, Mirabella, I am. I'm entitled to whatever I can take. And after I take it, I'm entitled to whatever I can keep. Your pa wants to keep me from blowing your fool head off. He ought to pay my price.
In other words, a rattlesnake on a motorcycle. The child asks a simple question. And my price is $10,000? An out-of-breath outlaw and actor replies,
yep.
A coy little hostage remarks, that seems rather high for little old me.
Sincerely, Caleb responds, that's where you're wrong, Mirabella.
Then, compelled by emotion, Rick improvises,
if I was your pa.
He stops. What? The voice on the other end of the receiver demands. Rick opens his mouth, but the words don't come out. The child on the other end of the phone demands, "If I were your pa, what?" Rick blurts out, "I'd cut off my arm to get you back." Silence fills the room and the scene, but Rick can hear Trudy's self-satisfied smile over the phone. Then after a dramatic pause, you could drive three trucks through. Trudy, as Mirabella comes back on the line and asks, "Was that a compliment, Caleb?" Then Trudy breaks out of character and describes stage direction. She reads, "Then Johnny comes up to the door. Knock, knock."
"Who is it?"
Caleb asks. Trudy adopts a deep cowboy voice and says, "Madrid."
"Come on in," Caleb orders.
Trudy tells Rick, "The rest of your lines are with Johnny, so I'll do Johnny's lines." With her throaty Johnny Madrid voice, Trudy asks, "What's the plan?" Caleb tells him,
"Plan is, Lancer meets us in Mexico 5 days from now with $10,000.
She drawls out, "That's a lot of money to carry on a long ride." Caleb snorts,
"That's Lancer's problem."
Trudy, as Johnny points out, "Something happens to that money, and we don't get it. That's our problem." Caleb spins toward Johnny and violently says,
"Something happens to that money. That's her problem."
With fire in his eyes, he tells Johnny Lancer,
"Get it straight, boy. In 5 days' time, Murdoch Lancer is going to pay me my $10,000. And if anything happens to my $10,000 before they reach us, we will not be understanding. The name of this game ain't I Tried."
Murdoch Lancer puts $10,000 right smack dab in my hand, or I crush her head in with a rock. Rick and Caleb breathe in and out hard after that explosion. Then, after taking the well-earned dramatic pause that George Cukor denied him, Rick asks,
"Now, do you got a problem with that, Madrid?"
Then Trudy, as Johnny, replies,
"My only problem, Caleb, is you keep calling me Madrid."
Caleb snorts,
"That's your name, ain't it?"
Then she says,
"Not no more. Now, the name's Lancer. Johnny Lancer."
Rick goes for the imaginary pistol hanging off his hip as Trudy on the other end of the receiver yells,
"Bang, bang, bang!"
Rick lets out an excruciating scream as he falls to the linoleum floor of his kitchen, clutching his face as if that's where Johnny shot him. On the other end of the phone, Trudy asks,
"What was that?"
On the floor of his kitchen, Rick tells her,
"I acted like I got shot in the face."
She coos an enthusiastic,
"Ooh, good idea."
Then after a beat, she says excited,
"Hey, man, that was a pretty frickin' good scene."
Rick sits up from the floor and leans his back against his refrigerator.
"Yeah, it was," he agrees.
His scene partner says, "We're gonna kill this scene tomorrow." She's right.
"Yeah," he says, "I think we are."
A moment of silence passes between the two thespians. Then the younger one reminds him,
"Wow, Rick, isn't our job great? We're so lucky, ain't we?"
And for the first time in 10 years, Rick realizes how fortunate he is and was. All the wonderful actors he's worked with through the years, Meeker, Bronson, Coburn, Morrow, McGavin, Robert Blake, Glenn Ford, Edward G. Robinson, all the different actresses he got to kiss, all the affairs he had, all the interesting people he got to work with, all the places he got to visit, all the fun stories he got to live, all the times he saw his name and picture in the papers and magazines, all the nice hotel rooms, all the fuss people made over him, all the fan mail he never read, all the times driving through Hollywood as a citizen in good standing. He looks around at the fabulous house he owns, paid for by doing what he used to do for free when he was a little boy, pretending to be a cowboy. Then he tells Trudy, "Yes, we are, Trudy. We're real lucky." His little scene partner bids him goodnight. "Good night, Caleb. See you tomorrow." And a very grateful Rick Dalton says, "Good night, Mirabella. See you tomorrow." And the next day, on the 20th Century Fox back lot, on the set of Lancer, the two actors knocked them dead. This is Jennifer Jason Leigh. This unabridged production of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, a novel by Quentin Tarantino, presented by Harper Perennial and Harper Audio, was recorded at Westlake Recording Studios in West Hollywood, California, and directed by Scott Sherritt, engineered by Matt Brownlee, assistant engineer Hayden Duncan. This program was produced by Tim Bader, Audio LLC. Executive producer, Suzanne Franco Mitchell. Text copyright 2021 by Visiona Romantica Incorporated. Lyrics from Little Green Apples, words and music by Bobby Russell. Copyright 1968 by Universal, Songs of Polygram International Incorporated. Copyright renewed, all rights reserved. Used with permission of Hal Leonard, LLC. Lyrics from Looking Out My Back Door, words and music by John Fogerty. Copyright 1970 by John Dora Music, care of Concord Music Publishing. Copyright renewed, all rights reserved. Used with permission of Hal Leonard, LLC. Lyrics from Secret Agent Man from the television series. Words and music by P.F. Sloan and Steve Barry. Copyright 1965 by Universal Music Corp. Copyright renewed. All rights reserved. Used with permission of Hal Leonard, LLC. Lyrics from Teddy Bear Song. Words and music by Don Earl and Nick Nixon. Copyright 1971 by Songs of Universal Incorporated. Copyright renewed. All rights reserved. Used with permission of Hal Leonard, LLC. Lyrics from There But For Fortune. Words and music by Phil Oakes. Copyright 1963 by Barricade Music, Inc. Copyright renewed. All rights in the United States controlled and administered by Elmo Music Corp. All rights reserved. Used with permission of Hal Leonard, LLC. Production copyright 2021 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.